Am I on? Great. Okay, folks, welcome. We have two handouts that you should have. One is a photocopy of the article that Candace had published this in the most recent issue of History News. The other one is a single-page handout. It could be yellow, it could be blue, it could be white. They're dispersed around the room. If you can't put your fingers on one, let us know and we'll make sure you get one. I'm John Durrell. I'm a consultant with QM Squared, a community of nonprofit consultants. And my job this afternoon is to facilitate a conversation about the power of transformation. We're going to talk about transformation of our organizations, of our communities, of the people in our organizations, the people in our communities, and of our industry, the industry of historic sites and historical organizations. For those of us who have been in the industry for a while, we know, because we've participated in a transformation that has been going on for at least 20 years, and a general move of the industry from being primarily internally focused and collections driven to more externally focused and more responsive to our communities and our audiences. This is a long process. It takes place time and again in organizations around the country. Some have embraced it and moved quickly. Others have been a little reluctant and moved more slowly. But I think you can see over time, if you took a program from ASLH 20 years ago and compared it to the program today, the number of sessions that talk about engaging audiences, evaluating the experience, holding dialogue in the community, the trend is clear. We want to find out what's going on. We want to make sure that we can understand and learn from one another about what is happening so that we can better lead it or manage it in our own organizations. This session was inspired by Kent Withworth, who is sitting here. Kent is the leads the Kentucky Historical Society, but he's also the program chair for this conference. And he, with Raleigh Adams, the president of the Strong National Museum of Play, wrote in their introduction, in the preliminary program that you all received, that the theme is transformation, the power of transformation. But in there he says, we want to have candid conversation about transformation. What does it mean? What are the implications? How do we understand it? How do we work with it as it happens? So that's what this session is about. And this is a double session. After the afternoon break, we will come back and do roundtable discussions and go a little deeper, having everybody share their own stories and their own experiences and their own questions and concerns about transformation in the industry and in their organizations. First part, for the first session, we have the benefit of the research done by Candace Metelic over her whole career, but certainly within the last decade or so, examining and trying to understand transformation, the transformation processes, and how a number of historical organizations have managed transformation over the course of the last decade or so. We'll first hear from Candace, And then we have four representatives of diverse organizations. We've selected them so that we can get a variety of understandings about what goes on in an organization as it changes, as it transforms. We have Charlie Bryan from the Virginia Historical Society. He's led that organization for 20 years, seen a lot of change, and now he's ready to retire and leave it to somebody else, and we'll talk about that as well, about leadership transition as part of transformation. Heather Beggs from the Pratt Museum in Homer, Alaska, who has a small to mid-sized museum in a small to mid-sized city, I guess. She has a remarkable museum in that it is very much on the side of that trend line of being engaged with the community and spends a lot of time engaged with the community. So she'll be able to speak a lot to how you use history and the power of history to transform or help a community transform. Cinnamon Catlin Legutko is with the Lew Wallace Study and Museum in Crawfordsville, Indiana, a small museum that is undergoing rapid transformation. 5 years ago, there were two volunteer staff. They now have two full-time staff and two part-time staff. So she's making a lot of changes relatively quickly. And then Renee Epps with the Tenement Museum in New York City, so a mid-sized museum in a large city, very much engaged with its community. For those of you just walking in, I want to make sure that you get the handouts. So after I turn things over to Candace, just hold your hands up and I'll make sure you get the handouts. The way we're going to proceed, Candace will present the key understandings that she reports on in the article that you received that was in History News. We'll start to get some conceptual understanding of transformation. I will then pose questions, an initial question for each one of our panelists, and then we'll open it up for your questions of them or your own stories about what's going on in your organizations. Okay? So, Candace, why don't you go ahead and go?
Thanks. We're going to run through some of the highlights very quickly because of the time frame of our sessions, of the material that's in the article. So I'm just going to try to hit some of the high points. The participating organizations that I worked with are up here on the slide, the Henry Ford, Detroit Historical, Minnesota Historical Society, Missouri Historical Society, the Strong Museum, National Museum of American History, and the Historical Society of Washington, D.C. The primary background that I need to tell you about this research is that it was not case studies. So it's a little bit different in terms of how I'm reporting out these key understandings. But it started with 77 long interviews, and they were consciously seeking multiple perspectives in organizations. So I interviewed directors, curators, educators, board members, and community members. Okay. And they actually ended up being organized by their primary advocacy, whether it was for the collections, for the organization, for programs, or for community. Then I did a review of four organizational literatures, and out of that found some patterns that I was able to put together in an analytical framework to look at all of this data. That led to a retrospective analysis, and what that means is that I was looking at patterns across organizations, and I was looking at major change that occurred over a 20-year period, roughly from 1980 to 2000. So it was sort of the last two decades of the 20th century. And that led to these key understandings. So these are things that have emerged across patterns across organizations. Okay, so it's at a higher level than individual case studies. So these seven key understandings sort of emerged as sort of clusters of important information in terms of what was going on in terms of change and transformation in these organizations. So I'm just going to run through each one of them and give you a few highlights of what happened in all of those. And we're going to start with the first one, which was that organizational change and transformation are inherently complex and difficult. This is not for the faint of heart, as I write in the article. It is necessarily or just inherently chaotic and traumatic. So hopefully that'll make some of you feel more comfortable if you've been through this and been dealing with this, because this just seems to be nature of the beast. It's chaotic from the standpoint that it does not happen in a linear sequence of events. It's all over the map. And it happens with many different things happening at once. So it's multifaceted, as you can read up there. Decisions, events, roles changing, the organization redefining itself. So it's really like the whole science of chaos. Okay, and it's very traumatic from the standpoint, I think one of the major things is that it really challenged some of the most deeply held convictions and beliefs in our field. And that's what some of these organizations were struggling with. They were struggling with the role of professional standards, doing things right versus doing the right thing. Okay? And it was really bucking the status quo. And the status quo in a way that many of us were trained, that museums should be, you know, the way they should be operated. Also, these organizations over this time period faced very tough challenges. In some cases, it was a major downsizing. A few of them at points even faced brute survival. So, I mean, it was not pretty. It was not easy. And so some of the things that came out, I mentioned the longstanding inwardly focused traditions. John mentioned the sort of movement to look outside and to engage community. That sort of took precedent over the old school priorities. There was a concept of changing functional roles, redefining what a curator was, what an educator was, what a director was. That was extremely difficult. And then across the board there was an anguish, that's the only way that I can describe it, about the terrible toll, and this came from one of the informants, that change took on people, on colleagues and stakeholders. So people really commiserated about that. In terms of the second key understanding is that organizational change, deep organizational change, requires human reflection at the interaction of heart and soul at a very deep level. This was about changing ourselves as we examined our own fundamental assumptions and values. It was about listening to our inner voices, and it was about developing the qualities in these organizations that helped everyone in the organization, not just those who had the position, to become change leaders. Okay? So the qualities of soul, and I know this is a little bit hard for some folks to handle, but this idea of the qualities described when people talk about soul, and there is a whole new literature on heart and soul in organizations. It's a wonderful and quickly growing literature. But they talk about meaning. They talk about memory. They talk about beauty. They talk about divinity. And they talk about union. Those are some of the key words that appear across. And they use these things as aids to help to understand underlying patterns of human behavior. So some of the examples, you know, to sort of pick out a few highlights. This was a very personal process. It affected people at all levels of the organizations and in all positions. There was a lot of passion that emerged as people were trying to do something important, something that mattered in the community as well as within the organization. And as I mentioned, this deep commiseration about staff, sort of bearing the brunt of change, if you will. The third one was about change agents and the role that they play in change and transformation processes. So who were they and what did they do? Very classic or very characteristic in terms of the organizational literature. They championed the change. They helped to reinforce and guide the process. So it's a very classic role that, you know, as you read the literature and you read what a change agent does. In museums, they took on the role of pushing toward this external focus. So it ended up being a real fundamental re-identification, repurposing, if you will, of the organizations. And what that did was challenge our existing organizational culture in a big, big way. So who were the primary change agents? Remember I mentioned the advocacy. Well, the folks who had the advocacy for community, for the entire organization, or for audience and programs, in those categories, those were the people that emerged as being the primary change agents. So who did I not mention? Curators, collections folks. There were a few, but for the most part, they were not assuming the role of change agents in this particular time period in these organizations. So how did they work? What are some of the things that those change agents did? Visioning was a very important part of it. There was a session this morning about Chicago, about the important role of visioning. It is a tool that has been used in many organizations to energize and propel and help people come on board. They used teams. They set up teams as guiding coalitions, consciously thinking cross-functional, not the management team necessarily, but people representing all parts of the organization to help to guide the change forward. And teamwork was a real important part of this because it changed people's roles, it changed power structures, it changed the way decisions were made, shook up a lot of the long-standing relationships of people in organizations, some good, some bad. A lot of organizations tried structural reorganizations. For the most part, that was not as an effective tool as people assume it is. Okay, so for lots of reasons. The fourth key understanding is that leadership matters a lot during change. And transformational leadership is a very effective strategy and approach. And that has been proven in all sectors in the management leadership literature, research literature. In terms of change leadership, just a couple sort of key things. Leaders found that it was very hard to balance internal and external concerns. That's really tough. The characteristics or the traits, when I asked people to describe what they thought was useful in terms of their traits for somebody trying to manage change, you can read them. Persistence, perseverance, comfort regarding uncertainty, chaos, ambiguity, because it is not a clean process. You got to be willing to sort of let things sort of be up in the air for a long time. The other important finding here in terms of change leadership across the board was the role of boards. And in these organizations, boards played a very important role. They became change agents, and most of the directors and most of the management folks said that they would not have been able to do the transformation they undertook without the strong support of the board. So the boards, in essence, had to model the transformation that they wanted to see for their organizations, and they had to build capacity and support for the change process. Let's talk about transformational leadership just quickly because it's a term that's bandied around, but a lot of people don't understand what it is. Okay? The research has defined transformational leadership as with these characteristics: appealing to followers' higher values to build commitment for an inspirational purpose. Okay, so that's beyond the normal transactional, you do a good job and I'll give you a reward of a salary or position or whatever. This is very different than that. Transformational leadership cannot happen unless you think about the collective. You have to embrace everyone in the organization to share the leadership role. So it's a shared leadership role, leadership at all levels. And the actions of those leaders tended to be more serving and supporting, sort of the coach-mentor sort of thing, rather than commanding and controlling. So you're not going to find an authoritarian leader being a transformative leader. Okay, transformational leadership is a rare thing. And because it's really tough, it takes a great deal of courage and it takes integrity to stand up and do what is right for the organization and put your own career and your own personal ambitions on the back burner. Okay, because there are a lot of transformational leaders that I know in this field who have taken a fall because they did the right thing for the organization. So it's a tough and rare, wonderful thing. Okay, the fifth understanding is that the quality of stakeholders' participation in the process definitely affects the outcome. if you look at the sort of the reactions to change, there is a continuum, and it's enthusiastic commitment at one end through outward resistance at the other end. And those of you who have been involved in trying to lead change, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm already seeing the heads nodding in the audience. So the supporters, those folks that got on board and embraced it, were very joyful. That's not a quality that we hear a lot about in our organizations, but they were joyful. And they described themselves that way about coming to work and about doing something important and the response that they were getting from their communities. On the other side, the reasons that people resisted change was primarily fear, and it was fear about losing control, power, their own competency, that they weren't going to be competent anymore, that they were going to lose the resources they needed, and of course the status in the organization. Now, out of all of that, the most critical concern for people at all levels was how people were treated during this process. And that was the determinant whether they were getting on board or not getting on board. If they saw people being treated very poorly, and it did happen, they were backing up and they were not going to get on board and they were going to resist. And what happened is that they backed up to a position of having to try to take care of their colleagues. So people learned to take care of each other during this process, especially when they saw people not feeling appreciated or whatever it was. So the lessons here is that meaningful participation, not lip service, but meaningful participation, helped people to understand the reasons for change. It helped to change people's attitudes and behaviors, and it built that sense of buy-in. And if it didn't happen, the reverse happened. So it happened either way. This was pretty cut and dry. And the lesson is that the leaders who are leading change need to help people understand the change process. Usually they needed more time than the leaders needed. The leaders were way ahead of them. The strategists were way ahead. So they needed to help people. They needed to help them come along. And they also needed to identify the informal leaders. Now, these are not position power leaders. These are the people who really have the respect of their colleagues as people, as individuals. And you needed to find those informal leaders and embrace them and give them a role to help to empower the change. And then the last one, of course, was treating people with care, paying attention, valuing human resources. Okay, so that leads us to organizational learning. That's the sixth key understanding. And that's a wonderful generative strategy that helps to build organizational capacity. This is another one of those things that people throw around. Oh, yeah, we do a lot of learning in organization, but that's not organizational learning. So we need to look a little bit at what do I mean by organizational learning. It means you're going beyond the status quo. It is the shift from short-term efficiency to long-term effectiveness, which is just a very different paradigm in how you think and act. The outcomes have to be organizational as well as individual. They can also be at the middle group, the group or team level. And the measure is that the new knowledge or tools or understanding has to lead to new behaviors or new patterns of action in the organization. So the components that seem to emerge from this research was the idea of valuing human resources, the meaningful stakeholder participation that I just spoke about, the idea of systems thinking, meaning that you are not thinking in just department or slice of time, but you're really thinking over time and you're thinking about the whole organization and the organization within its environment, its community, and the idea of embracing learning as a valued organizational outcome. Now, when I say that, I mean that's the learning that takes place is really more important than the successful exhibit or a balanced bottom line, because that is the key thing that's going to lead you to long-term sustainability, to make that paradigm shift. So the examples here were the organizations built capacity by investing in staff and board. There were a lot of wonderful, and I describe it in the article, ways that they got board and staff learning and working together. Community engagement was a really important factor in this learning process, and it basically transformed the way that these organizations did business. These organizations embraced teamwork, which of course changes hierarchy, changes everything else you do. They learned that changing structure does not alter existing working relationships. Just because you reorganize the organization and move people around and give them a new job title does not mean they change the way they work or relate with their colleagues and get work done. Okay? So that was a hard lesson for some of the organizations. They also learned that change required relentless attention and sometimes pushing farther than you wanted to go because the systems fought back. The old habits fought back. You had to just stay on it relentlessly to keep it moving, to keep that momentum going. The last understanding is about organizational change and transformation being inherently paradoxical. As history organizations balance their uniqueness and their connectedness to the larger enterprise that we live in. So that was about the competing values that exist within organizations. All organizations are filled with paradox. They compete with internal and external, with stability and flexibility sort of controls. And the couple of examples that seem to emerge very strongly, I won't go into much depth on these, because they really deserve their whole session all unto themselves. But there was this amazing tyranny of tradition, this conservative mindset, this idea that museums and history organizations don't change. And it was like if you were trying to change the organization, somehow it was like the norms of organization were in the collection. Or it was beyond, we don't do things that way. We've never done it that way. It was a very, very strong force in terms of change. And there was also this paradox related to the sort of sense of transformational leadership and seeking a higher purpose and really wanting to do something good. And there's a natural synergy while many of these organizations are struggling to survive. So it's really hard to think, you know, like a genius and want to do all this wonderful stuff if you can't pay the bills. So it's sort of this paradox. And then there was a strong paradox about organizational learning. I alluded to it a few minutes ago. We value the learning of visitors, learning as a product of our organizations, but we don't value our own stakeholders' learning or organizational learning. So those were sort of the seven key understandings. And now we'll take a look at some of our organizations. So we have a slide here for each of the organizations that I'll just flip up as our speakers are talking.
Okay, well, we'll go in this order. So what we'll do now, and the handout that you have, the single page handout, has outlined on it the seven understandings and some questions about those that you might have. We're going to use this as our guide for the conversation we are about ready to embark on. This handout will be used now as well as in the roundtable discussions in the second session. So be thinking about, and you can use the reverse to kind of write your notes or thinking about your own stories and your own experiences in this process, where you and your organization are and what are your questions and any of these understandings that that Candace has talked about. Do they give you some insights or some questions about what you're dealing with? We will start with my asking each of the panelists to respond to a question, and then we'll open it up to the point where you can ask them questions, and also you can then start to tell us your stories or your experiences with transformation. We'll start with the Pratt Museum in Homer, Alaska, and Heather Betts as the director there. So Heather, I'd like you to spend a moment just telling us about your museum, and especially in relationship to this topic of transformation. And then I'd like you to speak to this understanding that transformation is inherently chaotic and complex and shifts and starts and false starts and so forth, and some stories from your organization that may illustrate that.
Okay, sure. Can you all hear me all right? Is this mic working? Okay. Well, I'm Heather Beggs. I'm the director of the Pratt Museum in Homer. I've been there about 5 years, and Homer is 100 miles south of Anchorage, if any of you are starting to get familiar with Alaska geography now that we've got someone famous. Homer is a town of 5,000 people, and our museum is maybe approaching a mid-sized museum. We've got 12 staff members, six of them full-time, and about an $800,000 budget, annual budget. But in our small town, we have a very dedicated constituency, over 500 members in our town of 5,000. And the reason that we embarked on our transformational change in our community is that our region is really witnessing profound environmental, social, economic changes, which I'm sure any of you from small towns are experiencing as well. And in an effort to maintain our local and regional distinctiveness and our small town character, we embarked on a comprehensive renovation of our exhibits and programs through creation of a master exhibit plan, which really embraced community members at every turn. I like that Candace talks about relentless attention to people. I know she was talking about the individuals and maybe board members in your group, but in my case, I'll talk about some of the complexities in dealing with our many, many community groups that we involve as collaborators at our museum and what complexities and difficulties that brings. We really try to develop meaningful collaborations with all of our community groups, and they're quite diverse, although there's not perhaps much ethnic diversity in our community. We certainly see a lot of social group diversity and economic diversity that can pull at our community at times. We have Native Alaskan community groups. We actually have groups of very isolated Russian old believers that live in villages outside of our small town, a commercial fishing community, a very strong artist community, and living homesteaders as well, which I think is of particular interest perhaps to this group. So in involving all these folks in our exhibit design, which has been going on now for almost 10 years, so I've been around for about half of that at the Pratt, that relentless attention never stops. So even after you've started the transformational process and all of the lurches, I think, that happen at the beginning, you have to keep at it and keep people involved through every step of the way, really. What we've endeavored to do is create exhibits that are always changing, always responding to the needs of our community so that we remain a relevant source of information, really, to every community group. And as probably many of you know who serve small communities, you have to be everything to everyone, and that's never easy and always disappoints a few. So I guess some of my examples come from our homesteading community and their reluctance to change and how we've involved them. Just briefly, our master exhibit plan has changed our museum from our focus is on the art, science, and culture of Kachemak Bay, so it's a general museum, and we used to separate the art, the science, and the culture in different exhibit galleries, and now we've integrated all of those in thematic areas, rather. We have discovered there are 12 questions that people ask about our place. Who are we? Where are we? What are the dynamic forces that shape our place? How have we survived? Questions go on, and we have completed just phase one. We've answered five of the questions. And so even though those were installed in 2004, we find that the 200 people that were involved in that exhibit development have now spurned, you know, tenfold the number that want to participate in the answering of the next questions or don't like what they saw in the answer to that question. So we have to make sure that we're open to new interpretations constantly. So our homesteader group, there were a couple families that really got engaged in the first steps. And if anyone's eager to tell us our story, we're happy to record it and let them really tell their own story rather than us doing all of the interpretation and research ourselves. We find that both our local visitors connect much better that way, and our traveling visitors, which Alaska has a lot of, I'm sure you would guess, they certainly connect to our community in a much deeper way than just the curator's interpretation of a story. So we had some very engaged homesteading families, and then we had some families that once that exhibit was up were very angry at that homesteading family because they were getting all the glory in this. And so we basically meet community members at their place. We go to coffee shops where we've got our earth movers and hard hats sitting around their regular Wednesday morning affair. We go there. We go to the bar, the Salty Dog, and meet with the commercial fishermen and record sea stories. It's great fun. It's really talking about passionate people in our museum that are willing to go to bar night and record stories, of course. that passion that's everywhere. But anyway, we came to these homesteading. It was mostly women who were feeling left out. And so we created a homesteading women's tea. We brought out some historic china and served them all tea and recorded stories and ended up with a new exhibit which focused on five new theme areas that came out of that tea and involved probably another 20 women's stories and different families that were then involved in this new exhibit. Another way that we've addressed things after the exhibit has gone up, there's still, you know, a little faction of folks that want to see that chronological linear exhibit that just makes you happy to see Alaska in 1955 and 2005. But we certainly...
I like that.
I like it in places, too. We now have a little homesteading door that you can open up and see a timeline. But they really were struggling with the new exhibit concept. So we decided, and there was a little resistance from our staff. In some sense, you're just tired of meeting with all the groups. You're like, can't we just accept that some people aren't going to like this? Do we really have to go meet? Let them make their own exhibit. So it started out as let them make their own exhibit. We'll just tell them they can have a special exhibit space and come to us with a proposal like any other special exhibit, and we'll put it up. But what we found was that when we invited them as guest curators, that they were really interested in our process. And so we took it as a teaching opportunity to work with them, and we did over the course of 2 years to develop a temporary exhibit of, you know, quite a number of two-dimensional historic photographs and a lot of objects. But we certainly learned a lot from them and what they were bringing to the table and what they were actually going out to the community and acquiring new stories, new photographs, things that eventually were donated to the museum at the end of this special exhibit. So we certainly found a new respect for them, and they found a very new respect for us, a very healthy respect of the entire exhibit development process and what that entails. I don't think they want to do another one, but they want to participate in the next phase of our exhibits under the themes and kind of placeholders that we've identified to incorporate their stories. So it was really a beneficial process for all, but it certainly could have gone in a very different direction if we held that splinter group attitude in the beginning and didn't, you know, I guess swallow our own pride for a little bit and admit that there was something to learn from this. So that's probably enough.
Great, thanks. Thanks. Next is...
I'll let you do that.
Okay, Tenement Museum. In New York City, Renee Epps, the deputy director there. Renee, I'd like you to talk about, well, give us a sense of your organization in this context of transformation, and then talk about the quality of stakeholder involvement, how you get people involved, both on the staff side and on the community side, and what the challenges are with that.
Well, I feel like I'm following in good footsteps about the issues of stakeholders and soliciting feedback from people. But just very briefly, the Tenement Museum is located in Lower Manhattan on Orchard Street. We served about 135,000 visitors last year. We've got a staff of about 40 and a $5.5 million operating budget. I've been at the museum since 1991. When there was a staff of five that weren't getting paid always. So we've grown immensely since 1991. The museum was founded actually in 1988, so I came in pretty early into the museum and its development. Our main building is our tenement building at 97 Orchard Street that was built in 1863 by Lucas Glockner. He was a German immigrant and a tailor by trade. And we estimate that our building was home to over 7,000 immigrants over the years that it was opened as a residence from 1863 to 1935. The museum adopted as its mission when the museum was founded to promote tolerance and historical perspective through the presentation and interpretation of the variety of immigrant and migrant experiences on Manhattan's Lower East Side. And in that, we're using our building to tell the story of the former residents and the challenges that these people face and how these are the same challenges that new immigrants are facing today, that you're trying to make a new life for yourself, that you are working for a better future and you're trying to start a family with limited means. I think there's an inherent tension in the museum's mission. I mean, how do you measure tolerance and whether or not you're actually being successful in promoting something as sort of lofty and, you know, fairly airy as that. But I think that that's also kind of spurred pretty consistent internal reflection within the organization. And so that, in some ways, has been very helpful in the museum's development. I'm going to talk a little bit about just the newest exhibit that we've launched, which we just opened this June. And it's The Moores, an Irish Family in America, and it's focusing on the life of Bridget and Joseph Moore, who lived at 97 Orchard Street in 1869. They'd previously lived in New York's most illustrious slum of Five Points before they moved into our tenement building in what was at the time a very German neighborhood. So it must have been a bit of a culture shock for an Irish family to be moving into this primarily German neighborhood and certainly primarily German-tenanted apartment building. During the scant year that the Moores lived at 97 Orchard Street, they suffered the loss of their infant daughter, Agnes. And on the tour, we're inviting our visitors into the apartment, and we have interpreted it to talk about the wake that they are holding for their infant daughter. This exhibit was a long time in coming because of a variety of different issues, but one of the things that I think was great about just allowing there to be a good amount of time for the exhibit development is that we talked incessantly to many, many people, and it really helped shape this program. And the other thing to just really emphasize is that we're still talking, and there's still a lot of talk that needs to be had in evaluating and finessing and strengthening the program that we've developed. But throughout the program development, the people that we reached out to were incredibly varied. We went to individuals to get their advice and also get their support for the project. So we reached out to members of the Catholic Church. We talked to leaders in the Irish American community, which, as you can imagine, was also for some fundraising reasons. And then we talked to other historical organizations as well. We also established formal advisory groups. We brought in historical advisors that included experts in Irish and Irish-American history, historians of New York City history, and the history of health and medicine, because here we're looking at the death of this infant and trying to understand what was the social context for how this child might have contracted disease and what was going on in the 1860s surrounding medicine and health and issues of public health as well. We also turned to our contemporary organizations to help understand what was ringing true for them. Again, going back to that mission and saying, well, if we're talking about connecting the past with the present, let's talk to people that are now dealing with these issues. So we went and formed an immigrants advisory group that included new immigrants and also representatives from immigrant service providers. And they were wonderful in talking about the themes in the story and what resonated the most for them, what was really calling out, so that we were able to tease the threads out that we were developing, but understanding also what current communities were really feeling the most strongly about in that interpretation. We also have a teacher's advisory group that helped us focus on our educational goals. And one of the other things that I thought was so interesting is that we solicited high school students. We brought people into a mock-up of the apartment, and we talked with them about the age appropriateness of children coming in and discussing the death of an infant and a wake and what age they should be to go into that apartment. And instead of talking to adults, which I think are oftentimes very nervous about those kinds of topics, we talked to younger students who said, oh, well, I think, you know, your limit is seventh grade. But, you know, they were much more pragmatic in their feedback about that, which I thought was really helpful. We also have an access advisory committee that helped us shape the program as far as the delivery and the delivery devices so that we could include as many different types of visitors that may have different needs that are coming to our museum. And then our educators, the people that are actually giving the tours, we also have an advisory group with them, so discussing the feedback now that they're receiving from the visitors as they deliver the tour, also to help kind of cultivate them as leaders within this group of people that are delivering the programs, because there's a lot of anxiety that I'm hearing right now that this is a new tour, and oh my God, it's not just like the ones we had before, and it's new, and I, you know, you kind of like a little bit of heel dragging. So I think bringing them along and letting them see themselves as the leaders, and then to coach their own peers in how to give the best program and really get behind it. And then going through and just talking with every single department in the Tenement Museum, the people that are in the shop, the people that are in the visitor services department, the fundraising department, the education department, everyone, and saying, what is the feedback? What do you have to say? What are your responses? What do we need to do to change? What is a valid complaint? What are comments that we need to just do fine-tuning in our communications? For example, we realized that children might be sensitive to the issue of the wake, we weren't really explicit in telling all of our visitors that you were going in and seeing the coffin of an infant child. And we then got feedback from visitors saying, one visitor, I mean, very heart-wrenchingly, said that she had suffered the loss of a child through SIDS and said, you know, I wouldn't have taken this tour if I had known. This was too emotionally difficult for me. So, again, just constantly making sure that you have your feelers out there and that you can respond as nimbly and as quickly as possible. But while we've had this up and running, I must say it's still in review. We're still in a process of changing, and it's really trying to constantly manage that for all the staff and trying to be as clear as possible that you may not have the answers right now, but that this is a process and that they're going to be involved in it. And just the last sort of more positive note, we're just now developing a new exhibit for our storefront windows where we bring in a contemporary artist who will do an exhibit in response to our new tour, and she'll work with an ESOL class, English as a Second Language class. We also give English as a second language programs at the Tenement Museum. But we've done this in the past, and it is so amazing to see these ESOL students in New York City see their own stories elevated into an exhibit at a museum, and to come to the opening event. Maybe they don't normally leave the borough of Brooklyn where they live and work and go to school, but all of a sudden getting all dressed up to come out and celebrate this moment. So again, that other moment for bringing in different stakeholders is really powerful. And that's
great. Thanks. So we've heard from two institutions who are very much in the process of using the power of history to work for transformation of communities and audiences. Now we'll hear about transformation of organizations as they start to embrace this responsiveness to their constituencies and audiences. So next is Cinnamon, and Cinnamon will talk about her organization. You've been director for 5 years or so? 5 years. What's happened in that organization as she has led the transformation of the study and museum? And I'd like you to address specifically the role of leadership in making this and nurturing this and helping this to happen. I'm sure leaders don't make it happen, but you work towards it. So why don't you talk?
Thank you. Yes, I'm Cinnamon Catlin Gutko, and I've been the director since April of 2003 of the General Lew Wallace Study and Museum. Of course, it wasn't called that when I started there. That was one of our first big changes. It was known as the Ben-Hur Museum. You laugh, but let me tell you why. This is the site where General Lew Wallace wrote Ben-Hur, best-selling novel of the 19th century, never been out of print, goes on and on in terms of record-breaking as a true work of historic fiction that had never been seen before. But before Wallace became an author, he was a very famous, or to some historians, an infamous, Civil War general. We can debate that one for a couple days as well. But he had established himself on the national level as a general, youngest major general in the Civil War at age 34, very well known, but had always wanted to be an author and pursued all of his life adventures in a self-taught manner. It was a poor student. He was ornery is probably the best word for it. He loved to live outdoors and not attend the classroom experience, and was self-taught even at the Civil War level, and was a volunteer as he rose up the ranks. This theme, if you will, plays out in his entire life story. And the study itself, which is the brick structure you see in the image, is a manifestation of Wallace. Not only do we have his great story, where he also goes on to become the governor of the New Mexico Territory during the time of Billy the Kid, as well as ambassador to Turkey and working with the Sultan while he's there, and going on to write more novels, but he then chooses to build a study where he could spend his time and reflect upon what has occurred. This is very late in his life that it's built, 1895 to 1898, in his backyard. And today that backyard exists in the National Historic Landmark site that is surrounded by 3.5 acres of lush gardens in the middle of downtown Crawfordsville, which is about a town of 12,000 people, county of about 15,000. We are not on the beaten path. We're way out in western Indiana, not in the great state of Indianapolis, as some people well know, in Indiana. So we have to work very hard to get them out there. When I was hired, the museum had been in a stage of what I call caretaker mode. The people working there were part-time seasonal and were passionate about the Wallace story, passionate about the site, but really didn't have the skill set. And they knew it. It was a good situation for me to enter because they knew something needed to happen. And there was a board that was very small, and none of them knew how they had gotten there or what they were supposed to do. In fact, there were three boards, but that's a whole other story. So the one I really focused on was about five people. And they knew something needed to happen. The person I followed retired, and I was hired as a part-time person. I was able to do this because I was consulting, so I could fill out my whole week and spend part of the week at the study and lead them into the new phase of what we've been in for the past 5 years, the revitalization mode, as I call it. And it started with a plan. And when I say that we're a small museum, we truly were. The budget was between $30,000 and $40,000. It changes depending on what paperwork I look at, but it was between $30,000 and $40,000 in 2003. Two part-time seasonal people, no volunteers, a little over 2,000 visitors, and certainly no educational programming to speak of. We started with a plan that we did ourselves. We didn't have any money, so we figured out a way to write a strategic plan that would take care of the nuts and bolts. That's what had to happen. I mean, there was nowhere to store collections, and there were significant collections. Wallace's study had continued intact for 100 years with all of the contents, and they weren't being taken care of. And that's just one of a million ills that needed to be addressed. So the plan was aggressive, and it scared us at first, but we knew we could do it. So we started in headlong, still part-time, doing the best we could, slowly starting to see change. But by about 2005, we knew we needed to step it up, and that's when our mission statement changed. And it's really the guiding force for absolutely everything we do. We went from a mission statement that said you collect, preserve, and interpret, which I know many of y'all have or have heard of, to a mission statement that's much more inspirational, and it's to celebrate and renew belief in the power of the individual spirit to affect American history and culture. And we're using Wallace's story to inspire individuals to perform at the level he did, whether it's self-taught or pursuing their ideals, or at least thinking about your possibilities in this life to be more useful contributing citizens and help build community while we're at it in Crawfordsville. So with that sea change, it truly was a sea change, all of the nuts and bolts work identifying the plan made sense, but we had this new layer of inspiration that helped us communicate it to the wider audiences. Talk about an amazing fundraising letter we could write with a mission statement like that, and the list goes on of all the opportunities that mission statement started. And in that same year, we had the opportunity of it being our centennial year. It was 2005, and there had been no educational programming. So we rolled out an intense 2-week period of programming to just try some things on. And fortunately for me, that build had the board had built by that time into a very excited, dynamic, new type leaders in the town of the size that it was. All the same people were on all the same boards. Well, that wasn't happening anymore. They were not risk averse, and we started rolling it out. And we began with our cornerstone programming, the Lew Wallace Youth Academy, which is the two pictures you see with the children, where we talk about Wallace's story over the course of 5 days, but the underpinnings of all of it is to help educate about leadership, character, and lifelong learning. And we teach that to middle schoolers. And we bring in faculty. We're not teaching it. We're bringing experts on these topics in to spend time with the children for a week. And we're just now starting to do the evaluations 3-4 years out to see what the impact is. And it's very exciting. The kids remember everything they've learned. They're applying it. They become leaders. They're comfortable public speakers. And we hope that they just continue in that pattern. So that centennial year offered some buttressing to this transition. We could have that excuse we could hide behind that it was 100 years and come on, let's do something new. But it's sustained itself since then. Our budget is now $120,000 a year. 40% of that is funded by the city. The rest we fundraise through the Luwal Study Preservation Society, which is our 501c3. That's really our board governance. The city gave that organization governance. We grew from 30, maybe, members, like I said, here again, depending on what paperwork you looked at, 30 members to over 400 members in our membership program. We have a volunteer corps that grew from 0 to 100 or more, depending on the event. And our visitation has grown 223% since 2003. People are making the effort to drive out west and get off the highway and drive another 8 miles to see us. And the newest thing that we've debuted, and I just have to talk about because it just happened on Saturday, is we started a huge fundraising event called the Taste of Montgomery County. Doesn't sound very mission-related, I know. But it allows the rest of the year to succeed by bringing in restaurateurs and caterers on-site and excellent music, and we charge admission, and we take a cut from the restaurateurs' food sales. We have a fundraiser, but at the same time, we're reacquainting people with this 3.5-acre site that they never visit. I can't tell you how many people that come in now and say, I've never been behind these walls, because we do have this challenge of an 8-foot brick wall that surrounds the 3.5 acres. But we're bringing them in, and this has contributed to that population increase. So the biggest leadership style I think that I've adopted is to don't take no for an answer. Absolutely not scared of risk. We've put all of our eggs in many baskets and hoped for the best, but we've done it with a plan backing every step of the way. And then last but not least, not realizing that I wasn't alone. With a small staff, it's pretty obvious that I'm not alone because they're sitting there in the office with me. We share one space. But I also made sure that there were advisory groups, community committee groups, all sorts, doing the work together because we couldn't do it alone. So it also continues on their theme about talking to people, talking to people, talking to people, and getting them on the bus because we were having a really good time and we wanted people to come with us. And certainly courage and willingness to work for very little money in the beginning. And still, that continues. But knowing that it was going to pay off in terms of the purpose for which I do my work is much more fulfilling. And it makes me much more convincing as I bring others along.
Thanks. And our fourth perspective from Charlie Bryan, Virginia Historical Society, who's done the transformation over 20 years. And Charlie, I'd like you to describe the changes, describe the transformation, then also speak to bringing staff along. If you've encountered reluctance or resistance or confusion, how have you managed that?
Okay. I'm going to stand up just for a change of scenery. In talking about transformation and change, there are a couple of things to consider. If you don't do anything, your institution is going to change, and it's going to transform. And there is controlled transformation and controlled change and uncontrolled transformation and change. And I would say you would want to advocate controlled change and controlled transformation. And I know at the Historical Society there are certain fundamental questions you have to ask your institution on a periodic basis. And let me share some of those with you, and then I'll talk a little bit about our organization. First of all, I know you had a session on it yesterday, but why is history important? I don't know if we ask ourselves. We're in the history business, and why is history important? How is it relevant? What can we learn from it? And it's what we do at this institution on a day-to-day basis, a benefit to the public we serve. And we really need to ask that, and I don't think we do that enough. And then a very fundamental question, why should we change? I mean, are we changing for change's sake? Are we transforming for transformational? We need to ask ourselves, why do we need to change? And I think that is absolutely key to what we should do. Now, let me mention the Virginia Historical Society. We are old. We are so old.
How old are you?
We are so old that our first president was Chief Justice John Marshall. We are so old. Yeah, that's old. We are so old that during the Civil War, we invested our entire endowment in Confederate war bonds. That's old. Now, we've been around since 1831, and for much of the history of the Virginia Historical Society, we were a very inward-looking institution. As late as the early 1980s, if you wanted to be a member of the Virginia Historical Society, you had to be invited to become a member of the Historical Society. I'm not making that up. We saw ourselves primarily as a research library. We were a gentleman's learned society for nearly 100 years, and then for beginning really about the 1940s up through the early 1980s, mid-1980s, we operated almost exclusively as a research library. We were headquartered in a building, we are to some extent, we've changed, in a building called the Battle Abbey of the Confederacy, which is a museum and memorial to the Confederate soldier. Up until the mid-1980s, we had one lecture a year, which was on Robert E. Lee's birthday. Come hell or high water. We had a board that was all white, all male, all Richmond. And again, it was invitation only to become a member. But fortunately, beginning in the mid-1980s, our board of trustees began to realize that we could no longer afford to continue along that path of being a closed institution and an institution that serves scholars only. As late as 1988, we had about 5,000 visitors a year, and the majority of those were scholars coming to use our library. Well-known in scholarly circles throughout the United States, but virtually unknown in Richmond, even though we've been around since 1831. I was very fortunate to come on board in 1988, 20 years ago this month. And I know a lot of my colleagues warn me, you don't want to go there. It's a place that's very inward-looking. But when I came for the interview, I got a very strong sense from the Board of Trustees that they wanted this place to change. And that is absolutely fundamental. It has to a great extent, start with your board. And if you do not have your board with you and you do not transform that board to go with you, it simply won't work. But they were ready for that transformation. And again, we began to look, you know, why is what we do important? And in terms of involving the staff, in 1988, we had a staff of 35 people, good people who in many ways had been taught to look inwardly but not to look outwardly and not to look at our institution and look at it in comparison with what other historical institutions were doing in the country. And one of the first things I did as a leader is to assign members of staff. I want you to take the Missouri Historical Society and the Chicago Historical Society, institutions that I regarded as leaders in the field, and study them. What are they doing in terms of programs and what can we learn from them? And we spent a good bit of time comparing ourselves to those institutions and how can we benchmark ourselves. And we saw that we were falling short of what the rest of the profession was doing. Then we looked within Virginia. And believe it or not, we came up thanks to a consultant, he said, I want you to take your four or five biggest competitors. The competitors? Well, competitors for public attention, competitors for collections, competitors for board members, all kinds of things. You're not trying to drive each other out of business, but they're competition. And look at them, and what do they do well that we're not doing? And we did that. It's Colonial Williamsburg, Monticello, Mount Vernon, a number of big ones out there. And here was a little old Virginia Historical Society. What can we do? And we came up with an idea that we could fill an important void in Virginia. And that was the fact that Virginia was one of the few states in the country not to have a state history museum, all of Virginia history under one roof. You go to Monticello, it's just Jefferson. You go to Colonial Williamsburg, it's just Colonial. But we, with our collections, being crossing four centuries and more than in all regions of the state, could serve as the state history museum. And this is something that our staff began to rally around, and it was a good point that our board could rally around, and it was something we could go to foundations and to potential donors. And we would say, you know, Virginia, of all states, should have a state history museum. Kansas has one. Tennessee has one. Even West Virginia has one. And that was the kicker right there. And simply by, and then we started talking about filling voids that exist. Teachers in the Commonwealth of Virginia had no opportunity to learn history unless they enrolled in graduate programs in school. We could provide that. We could fill that void. We can be the state history museum. We can be a better library. And so as a result, over the last 20 years, and this is greatly condensed, we've quadrupled the size of our building. We do programs all over the Commonwealth of Virginia. We now have a staff of a little more than 100. And we've raised $110 million. Pam C., our vice president for advancement, who's been with us nearly 20 years herself, has helped lead that effort. And it has been an important transformation involving staff, board, and general public. And one thing I can say, I've said that I was interviewed by a reporter not too long ago, we've done that without a whole lot of blood on the floor. You hear of a lot of institutions that go through a major transformation, and a lot of people leave disgruntled and upset, and there's major fissures. We lost a few, but not that many. Maybe we can talk about that, how we went through that process, that we were able to retain most of the old guard, and we picked up a lot of the new guard, and it, for us, has worked well. So why is history important?
Charlie,
and, yes.
Go ahead and just say one or two of the things that you did to actually retain the old guard.
For one, we, I guess subtly and not so subtly, we played on state pride and regional pride that we're doing something very, we're doing this for the people of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And we, in developing the museum program, we had a great museum collection, most of which was in the basement, in boxes. And we would bring potential donors and trustees who had been convinced that we should only be a research library. And we would ask a simple question, why should these things be in the basement? And can you help us bring them out and use them as teaching and learning tools? And we want you to help us do this. We, what we have to offer to the people of the Commonwealth of Virginia is unique. It's special. And we, and people bought into that concept. And we also, again, talked about the importance of history and why it's relevant. It's not a very good answer, but it is. We did constant informational sessions, luncheons, show and tell luncheons and dinners like that, bringing a wide variety of people on a regular basis. And for us, it worked. I don't know if that...
Thanks. We have about 20 minutes left. So I want to entertain questions from the audience about transformation, your own organizations, any questions you have of the panelists. And if you can't think of something, look at that handout, the transformation reflection sheet, and see if there's any questions there that you want to ask. Anybody have a question? Here.
No, a lot of the, when we talk about transformation.
Excuse me, we're recording, so.
You're not loud enough until they shut up, so. I know a lot of what we talk about transformation, and there seems to be, like, obviously different times when organizations go through transformation. And, you know, one of them is kind of, you know, we've had great examples of when those have happened. When you've seen change because of economics and perhaps financial constraints, and all of a sudden there's a real pressure that we've got to change because now all of a sudden everything started looking at earned income and perhaps even this whole debate between mission and special use versus preservation. And there's almost a forced transformation as opposed to taking your time, having the luxury of looking back. And have any of you gone through that, and do you have any comments? Candace, we kind of talked about a little bit the other day. And, you know, just in general, how those have happened, and maybe some, are there any advice when you're going through transformation because it's really forced upon you from external factors?
Can be. I'll take a stab at it. I think the best example of this in recent years has been the National Museum of American History at the Smithsonian. I'm on that board, I must admit. And up until maybe 10 years ago, it received most of its funding from Congress. And as a result, exhibitions were prepared to a great extent by the curatorial staff and controlled by the curatorial staff. One could argue maybe too much so. But in recent years, with the cut in funding from Congress, they have had to go out like the rest of us and raise large amounts of money, and for better or for worse. And in some cases, those gifts have come with strings attached. What you know we call venture philanthropist. I'll give you the money, but I will say you've got to do A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. And they're really struggling with that. And it is a balancing act that we all face. And one other good example, James Madison's home, Montpelier, has been transformed from a DuPont mansion back to the way it looked when James Madison lived there. And, of course, $20 million from Paul Mellon made that possible. And that's a case in point where dollars went with a major physical transformation. It probably would not have happened without that gift. So there, money and transformation to a great extent go hand in hand. Anybody else?
I'll share one quick example, and that's when Harold Scramstead went to the Henry Ford Museum in 1981, he was presented with a $2 million deficit. In a very closed organization that had 50 years at that point or so of history, and a very closed board, and a strong, strong resistance to any change because most of the stakeholders did not realize the gem that they had. And the most stunning thing that lesson that I learned as a staff member there at that point and watching his approach to this was that he did not take the traditional path of cutback, 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 cutback. He did not tell everybody, cut your budget, cut your budget, cut your budget. What he did is start spending money. And he spent money to develop product. It's counterintuitive. And he got a lot of resistance, death threat. I mean, you can't imagine what he went through to do some of this. But it was really amazing because by doing that, by working on the internal transformation and by investing in product, for the first time ever, he was able to go out to foundations and corporations and outside support. He was able to convince the board to diversify itself and its portfolio. So it was the most dramatic lesson that I've ever seen in my career of sort of that economic peril facing you and taking a very non-traditional way to turn it around.
Would you just expand on that board piece you touched on, what the board did?
Well, the board when he arrived was all family members. So it was pretty closed. And it had been that way for a long, long time. And the portfolio was primarily in Ford stock, when it took a dive, the organization was really hurting. So he had to work with them to open up themselves as an organization and to bring outsiders on the board, so to diversify that board, to help them all to understand, the internal stakeholders and the local community to understand that this was not a Dearborn Community Center. It was not just for the locals. It had this amazing international value as an organization in terms of collections, programs, service, all sorts of things. And even in terms of its role within the larger metropolitan area. And all of that was a paradigm shift for the stakeholders. And then he really had to ask for an amazing amount of trust and grace to say, you have to let me spend some money. We can't take the traditional path of just cutback, or we're going to die. All the best people will leave. We will have nothing to turn this around with. Okay? So he started investing in, you know, education and programs and new exhibits, and people thought he was nuts, but it worked.
I'm a little concerned. This seems like we're using the terms change and transformation interchangeably. I wondered if all of you, as each of you as panelists, would comment on it, because to me they're very different, and maybe I'm wrong, but is change the same thing as transformation? Is transformation a different animal or a different species of animal, or what?
I guess I see transformation as something that's completely comprehensive in your organization. I mean, you can change a program or change an approach to interpretation, but in our example, I think that we've embraced it wholeheartedly. The board has completely changed their relationship, really, to the community and the way that they help us collect stories, the way that they fundraise, the way that they plan strategically. So I think it's a complete organizational change that is transformation.
Anybody else? I'll take a stab.
I think it's you're elevating change. I mean, transformation is change that is elevated organizational-wide, and also understanding that is it just a change that you're implementing, or what is that end result for, and really guiding everyone through that process so that they understand that. It's not just we're going to do something different now. It's because of a greater goal that you have set.
Well, and I think transformation takes a longer time. I mean, just change can happen pretty quick, and if you don't manage it well, you're going to see the results go poorly. But transformation, for me, is not only a long-term process and looks way out into the future as well, but it's also the personal reaction we have, which helps the larger picture happen. So it seems like it's happening on that touchy-feely, warm and fuzzy level, as well as the operational level. It's truly an experience. To me, that's the difference.
I'll say what Lou Wallace would have said. Transformation is strategic. Change is more tactical. In order to transform, you have to change. Change is more immediate. Just like lifestyle habits, you can change. You can start eating too much or not enough. You will change. But it takes an attitude to transform yourself to let that change go for a long time. So that would be my definition: transformational, strategic, change, tactical, more immediate.
In the article on page 8, the second paragraph, is a summary of how researchers distinguish between these two terms. They talk about change as being episodic or infrequent, and transformation as being constant and evolving. And transformation is described as frame-breaking, large-scale, major, revolutionary, the type of change that challenges strategy, culture, assumptions, values, and current operating premises of organizations and their members. And that's just what you heard from our panelists.
John, can I make a comment about being a leader of change? I think if your organization is working well, much of the change, the ideas for change, will come from your staff and will filter up. And I know I've said this many a time. I've gotten too much credit for what's going on at the VHS. We have a remarkable, bright, dedicated staff, and so many of the great ideas and the transformation came from within and from them. And you as a leader have to be willing to accept that and accept that change and accept that transformation. And I think that's so very important. And you, if you can allow that to happen, that's where important, fundamental, and profound transformation for the good will happen.
In a second. You want to get one from the back here.
I'm curious about the, with the leadership of the organizations that you studied, Candace, thinking about the change agents, the leaders of the change transformation within organizations, are there similar personal characteristics that you see in each of those leaders? And given the discussion that will be going on during the week at this meeting about the future of the history field and succession planning and so on, if indeed there are similar personal characteristics, is that something that we should be thinking about training people in? Or is it something that has to be inherent in who you are? Or is it something that can be taught and learned?
I think it is something that certainly can be learned, but it also is something that comes from within, and it comes from a self-centered, being centered and being confident, first of all, to be able to share leadership, power, and control with others. You heard the panelists talking about how this has to be a collective effort. You can't do it if you are insecure, if you are a control freak, if you are an authoritarian leader. And the other sort of really interesting piece of this is that the transformational leaders are not necessarily charismatic. In fact, it's a really interesting thing because you can use charisma as a hook to initially engage people. But most transformational leaders through history are not the ones who are charismatic because, think about it for a second, charisma is the focus is on the leader. In terms of transformational leadership, the focus is on the collective. It's just like what Charlie was just saying. This is not about you. It's not about any individual as a leader. You can't do it by yourself. And I would argue that even that organizations can't do it unless they embrace leaders at all level, unless you work with organizations outside the organization.
I want to follow up with a question for the panelists. Do you have any stories of anybody who emerged as a catalyst for the transformations that you've experienced that you didn't expect they would be a catalyst?
I do. I often talk about having a small museum effect occurring where the staff and board work so closely together because really the staff is filling, or I'm sorry, the board is filling some of the roles that the staff can't cover. So gathering the people to make that happen was a challenge, but also finding the right people who could grow into a role that you saw for them. And our first really excellent board president was an amazing catalyst. And it was because he was someone who had not been the usual suspect. He was not on all the same boards in our small town. He had no baggage. He had nothing but an innate sense of leadership and a willingness to learn about nonprofit. He'd never served on a nonprofit board before either. He allowed me to tell him what he needed to do. But he also had that innate characteristic. And so his term as president was what I call the house cleaning term, where he got rid of two pretty problematic board members. He was not afraid of dismissal. And when we realized that it wasn't in the bylaws, we sent it out to the membership and got that changed, that dismissal procedures were in the bylaws. And he didn't give up. So that he found a way to create the board situation so that someone could follow him and have that the best role possible as a president. And our board president now is someone who has been instrumental in leading the Taste of Montgomery County as festival experience, and he whipped it into shape. So it's been for us our board president, and that person has led everybody else along, and when they don't come along, he cuts the fat and keeps going.
I have maybe a contrasting example to a board president, but a staff member of mine who is very soft-spoken, just a silent listener, I think, for most of her meetings with community members, was very engaged with the Native Alaskan communities of our area. But through this very prolonged, 10 years of listening and gathering stories, she built this trust and integrity that I think followed and we all learned from the way that she dealt with the Native communities of our region in the way that we ended up leading the organization, being me and the board members, just through this very silent example of honest listening and integrity. And I think that that has really propelled a lot of our programs forward on many other facets of what we do at the museum, just taking that honest approach, because people are far more willing to share openly with you and give you their true story and keep coming back if it's very obvious that you're in it for that reason.
This is for Cinnamon and then my fellow Virginian. How did you go out to repurpose yourself into the community so that it wasn't just that closed group and expand out? And then I have a question
for you, too,
on your budget. So
that's a good question. For me, it was about truly being the face of the organization and getting out there in the community, attending events in the community, even though I wasn't living in the community yet, also that was a challenge. But by the time I moved to the community 3 years later, after starting, it was a vast improvement of people affiliating me with the success of the organization, volunteering incessantly, because they would see me everywhere. I mean, small towns, you do have that exception where you're at the grocery store and you suddenly leave with a volunteer. But it does happen. But there were also leaders in town that weren't that extroverted. So I would say that my extroverted nature was to my benefit. But then also, I've taken it to the next step where not where am I showing up to these things, but I'm taking a role as a volunteer in the community. I need your help, and I'm going to give you my help while I'm at it so that we build community together. And that's kind of the new phase of leadership I'm in, if you will, because I do live there and I enjoy the community immensely. And there have been strange political things that have happened lately, and I believe that the more of us who want something from the community give back, then it's all going to be for the betterment, and we'll transform a community in the end. I mean, that's my hope. Charlie.
Mention three things. When I came, no one had spoken to Rotary Clubs, Gowanus Clubs from the Historical Society, and I felt that was an important way of getting the message out. So I, from the get-go, said I would do that. I had, for many years, a monthly radio program in which I went on and talked about the great flu epidemic in Virginia or whatever, and that got the name of the Historical Society out. Three or four times a year, I write an op-ed piece in the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and it draws attention to the Historical Society. So that's an important part of what you do. When I came to the Historical Society, we had absolutely no PR program. We were maybe in the paper once or twice a year. And Pam C. was the first person I hired when I came, and she did a great job of coming up with press releases and stories that got us in you know, very clever and interesting ways that worked very effectively for us. Third thing, and this comes back to the first one, Paul Levengood, who is in the back, will be my successor. And when the search committee began to interview for my successor, I suggested that every candidate who comes in to interview give a public presentation. We rarely hear of that in our field, but to get up in front of an audience, give a 20-25 minute talk on a topic of your choosing, because if you're in this job, you are out there, and that's a big part of your job and your persona. And I'm surprised that more organizations don't do that as part of the job interview process. And Paul did a bang-up job on his presentation, and that's something to think about if you're involved in a board. When you look for that director, see how he or she does in front of an audience. Not that it will make or break your institution, but it sure can help.
Okay, we're coming up on time. Before we break, I have a couple of things that I'd like to ask you to do. First of all, the single sheet with the seven understandings printed. If you only have one, find another one. We have extra copies. And when you go out into the break, hand it to somebody. And encourage them to come back. We're going to have roundtable discussions. The six of us will be here to talk. We're not going to talk about their institutions. We want to talk about your institutions and what challenges you are facing in transformation. We'll see if we can learn from one another by talking about the realities of what you're dealing with. And third, if you come back, we will have a drawing. And one of you will win the secret to transforming your organization without any pain. We're going to collect, we're going to learn from you and try to gather these lessons about transformation. Can everybody hear me? Okay, great. And it's going to be recorded so posterity can hear me as well. We initially talked about resistance to the changes or transformations that are going on. We had an incident of a curator who resisted and eventually left the organization. we had a counterexample of somebody who, in that case, a conservator, who was asked to really play a special role in the transformation, where conservation was asked to step up, and she was asked to step up to be a leader, and she became an active participant and agent of the transformation. But we did have some discussion about, you know, how long is enough? You want to encourage people to go along, but at what point is it time to say, I'm sorry, this isn't working, it's time for you to move on? And David Crossan told about, the parable of the anchor, where you're trying to get your ship to go, and ultimately you just reach a point where you got to cut the chain, and all of a sudden you've got the wind behind you and things happen. And that's a judgment call on the part of the executive director as to how long you can go with that. We mentioned the book First Break All the Rules, because we got into talking about how important middle managers are to transformation and how they can stifle it if they're not fully on board. And a book called First Break All the Rules is it's an excellent study about how middle managers in private for-profit sector can determine the profitability of a corporation by behaving in certain ways. We had a case of an organization in stagnation where the leader says we have to change, but there's not a lot of obvious reasons why you have to change. Things are okay, but it's kind of at a plateau. Some suggestions: holding a strategic retreat, getting people, just posing these kind of fundamental questions. What do we want to achieve? Are we happy just not doing anything new? What do we want to achieve? Or going into those deeper questions, if we didn't exist, who would care? Why would they care? But kind of energizing the organization by asking hard questions, impetus to change. We talked a little bit about how boards work and how important it is to get the board behind the change. Talked about using strategic agendas with the board so that it's not just a bunch of report giving, but the board is engaged in the important discussions. Talked about how do you get money for transformation and transformation projects. So got into the question of boards, the board's role in fundraising and development. Let's see. We talked about, we had an incident of declining attendance, meaning declining revenue, and that the leadership in the organization were coming up with a solution, a so-called solution to the problem, which seemed to be sidetracking. It was not a really fundamental transformation. It seemed like a kind of a wild idea that might work. And the frustration of staff in kind of having no control over this kind of activity, and we really didn't have much in the way of solution, except that for staff who find themselves where they fundamentally disagree with some direction that the organization is going, and have no power to change it, to remain true to yourself rather than playing some game, and then in this case, because a new leader will be coming on board, to kind of position yourself to be able to influence or at least have a conversation with the new leader, because at this point the staff concerned are kind of cut out of the decision making. So it's kind of a perspective from somebody who doesn't have power, as opposed to most of our conversation, which has been about the leaders and how they work with the organization to bring about transformation. We talked about the web and how that increasingly is going to be an important part of the transformation of organizations. Talk about reaching out into the community, and if you're not kind of looking at that as a part of your transformation, that you may miss the boat with the younger generations coming online. This may be the norm, the way you reach people and engage people and interact is electronically. It may become the norm rather than the exception as it is now. And then we circled back to the people again. We talked about helping people through the transition, recognizing that things don't happen overnight and that people have to have a certain level of comfort. In and you know, it doesn't work for the director just to come out and say, we'll do it. But you have to kind of work with people. On the other hand, don't delay everything until everybody's on board, because it won't happen. And so, again, it's the judgment call. And Larry pointed out kind of a technique of saying at the beginning, push it. Because a lot of people have to see that it works, or see that it could work, and see that it is valuable before they decide to get on the bus. And if you're waiting around for them to get on the bus before you push things, so it's, again, leadership calls for pushing, but also being sensitive. And then we had a comment that a lot of times the change agents over time, the people who are still holding back, the change agents will ultimately confront the people who are holding back and say, you either have to get on or you have to leave. So it doesn't always fall to the director to have to do this. The peer pressure can happen. So I think that summarizes what we did. So who wants to go next?
Our group basically went through the list during our reflection time, and then we took time to share with each other some of the elements of the key understandings that struck our organizations independently the most. One organization was really interested in the fact that they have opportunity to possibly build a building, but yet instinct is dictating otherwise. So, to what? I'm sorry. So that perhaps what's really needed is to look at a more larger perspective and get away from the idea of a building being built, and maybe look at other ways to integrate the mission into the community. So that was one of the discussions we had. We also talked about opportunity a great deal. That probably was the center of our conversation, about opportunities in communities. And sometimes opportunity can be found in really negative situations, like budget cuts. Maybe it forces you to make a significant change that leads to transformation. So being able to recognize that as a leader is very key to the process. I'm trying to think of things we talked about that isn't redundant. We also talked about how action can be matched to a plan that's in place, and how to energize your board to make that happen, and how do you get those parts moving forward to create transformation. Because as we all know, there are many stakeholders in the process, and sometimes you feel pretty alone. So how to make that happen is something we grappled with. And one of the last things we talked about with our organizations is needing to take time to reflect on change and how it affects transformation, not taking enough time to think about it and to make sure you understand where you are in the process. So we then summed up what we've learned about transformation. And there were just four key things that we really feel like we learned today, is that there are phases of transformation, and you need to stop and consider where you are in the process. It's just as valuable as knowing that you're in the transformation. But to take the time, be reflective, and consider where you're at, and do that 360 view. We also talked about how we don't take time to think, that there's a forced thinking mode that we're often in, whether it's strategic planning or some other planning effort, and we don't take reflective time, which is different. And sometimes, to get that reflective time, you need to get out of the building and have that quiet inner conversation with yourself about where you're at in the transformation process. Also, we talked about how in the field, in this history field, we've become technicians. I really like this phrasing. We've become technicians, and we're not trusting our gut as much as we should. And that gut is there for a reason. And as I shared, 90%, 95% of what I do is totally from the gut, and then I clean up afterwards. But maybe I didn't say that. But the key is to listen to your gut and then make that strategic and make it something you can convey and communicate and get people behind. And then lastly, you don't need to forget those stakeholders and facilitating the thought for them as well. So you're having your reflective time, that's all fine and good, but you need to get the stakeholders thinking of that as well. And that is what we learned.
I'll start very briefly.
Candace was very nice to have actually organized our conversation into the themes of the questions. But I'd like to remind John that the first question was that organizational change is not linear, and neither was our conversation in any way, shape, or form. But I can run through the kind of basic points that we touched on. I thought it was a very good, spirited conversation, and really everyone grappling with the difficulties, not just top managers dealing with a board and then dealing with their managers below, but people in our group in a variety of different positions, so a variety of different perspectives of where people were going and what they're needing. But people are asking to be given an understanding of their roles and responsibilities and understanding who is delivering the message, and also that maybe at times there needs to be somebody from outside the organization that can help deliver the message, particularly if you're having an issue with managing up and the person in the CEO level is resistant to change and isn't trusting the staff's messages that are being delivered. Also talking about issues with structures of the board, how to manage a collection staff that can get completely out of control seems like a resonant theme with everyone. I wonder what's going on with those folks. And again, needing to deliver to all of the staff that transition can be painful and to acknowledge that that it does cause upheaval and that you're hearing what people are saying about the transition. Needing to have board buy-in and also to be constantly out there cultivating your board and renewing your board so that you're not stuck with people that have got their feet way in the past of the organization as you try to make those transformations. Needing to understand and disseminate both the long-term goals and mission. Balance your challenges against the positive. A lot of times people are saying that when there's something very exciting within the transition, if you're there pointing out some of the problems, some of the pitfalls that you may need to plan for, that can be seen as you being a naysayer, when instead you're really just wanting to make sure that the road is clear, that map is clear, and the way that you're going to get there needs to also be strategic about problems that may be arising from the new direction that you're taking, no matter how exciting that could be. Really needing to make a safe and appropriate space for your staff. They need to be able to have a forum that they feel really comfortable in to both voice the negative and the positive and get staff to really understand what power they have in both being positive and negative. We talked a little bit about the terrorists that could be within your staff and how they can really bring people down and how to manage them, and at times, unfortunately, needing to manage them out because that power can be really destructive. You need to train staff and make a real commitment to them and help remind them why they're still there and give them a forum and voice so that they can speak in front of their peers about why they're still there and create that kind of a sense of excitement that they can generate for everybody, because that's much more powerful than just the leader coming in and going rah, rah, rah. If you can give all levels of staff a way to express their thrill of working at the institution, it's going to create a much better buzz for everybody. You need to help staff reevaluate their priorities as well. A lot of times when there's change, you've got the roadmap that was already laid out for you for the year or for the next several years. And as that change is coming, staff need to know what they need to focus on. And so there needs to be a really concrete conversation so people don't end up getting overwhelmed. Needing cross-departmental accountability and respect as well. Needing to empower all of your staff to be able to call each other on maybe not setting the best standards within your organization, and so that you empower everyone to then do their best. Communicating to the staff what you will get out of the change as well, which I thought was a really useful thing to think about. What is that staff member's personal investment in the change that you're proposing within the institution? Because it is all about me or you or him or her. And people really do need to understand how they're going to be helped, what good it's going to be, because a lot of times they may feel like they're losing ground in some way and not really understand how their growth or the how they might grow and expand in the organization. And I think that was it.
Does anybody have anything you want to add? Fresh thought or something that's not been said? Hang on.
The imagery that came to mind, I don't know if you guys have seen the movie Monsters, Inc. It came out, those of you with kids have, I'm sure. It's one of my favorite. But the underlying theme is that joy and laughter is exponentially more powerful than fear. And that's what I heard, you know, some of the subtext and what you were saying. And I think that's sort of what Dr. Regan was saying today, too, in some respects. And I think we've got to tap into that at every level. And so as you were talking, I was flashing back to Monsters, Inc., and at first I thought, why? And then it hit me. So anyway, I just had to share that.
Anyone else? I don't know if you can top that. Okay, thank you all for playing in and keep the conversation going. This is in kind of museum industry wide. Everybody's going through this in one way or another, and the best way to get through to work towards the goals of transformation is to work together. I came away with one overriding lesson. And you got to talk and you got to listen, and then you talk some more and you listen some more, and you talk some more and you listen some more. This is not about, well, let's go ask them what they think and then moving on. It's a conversation that goes on inside your organization and with your community continually. The transformation, the deep change is your organization now talks and listens. So thank you all. See you around.